Every leader has problems. Increasing your leadership intensity won't fix them in a healthy way. You need an increase of clarity. From starting businesses, leading multiple nonprofit organizations, both large and small, and a full family life, Dr. Chris McAllister learned how to shift his thinking to thrive. He will help you order your internal world so you can lead your external world. Welcome to the Site Shift Lead Podcast with Chris McAllister.
All right, so here we are, number three for the Site Shift Lead Podcast, and so glad you're here. We're working through a progression, and if you track with this progression, you're going to learn to figure out who you are apart from what you do, how to get clarity in your doing, and really start investing in building great relationships. So super fast, everything that's processing in your brain, it's going through your thoughts, it's coming through the filter of identity. It's actually how your brain, your thalamus works. And so we want to learn to cooperate with this. We don't want to fight against it. And for so many of us, what's happened at this point is we've learned to hide or prove. And so go back and listen to the second podcast. You'll get that. When we hide and prove, it's because we're insecure. And hiding and proving will not fix the leadership problems that we're in right now. It'll only make them worse. For me, as I've looked at my own journey and analyzed this and wrestled with it and thought tons about it, I keep coming back to this concept that became so clear to me when I realized I've been ignoring the stuff that I've got to pay attention to. A number of years ago, I was on a river that you could actually do whitewater rapids canoeing on. It was insane. It was the lower three classes of rapids, if I remember correctly, but it was bad enough that one day on this river, I saw a canoe wrapped around a rock from the water pressure getting in on both sides of the boat. So I'm on this river with a buddy of mine the first day, and we're just like a giant pinball machine. We're slamming into these rocks. I think every rapid we hit, we flipped the boat. I had a little lump forming on my knee. It was brutal. And this is like a 4 or 5 hour trip down this river. We get to the outfitter, and the outfitter is obviously seeing the condition of his boat and I think pretty upset. And he says, I need to show you guys how you go through the rapids. He gets down in the boat, gets his center of gravity really low on his knees, and he says, I want to show you every time you come to those rocks, you're instinctively leaning back away from the rock. Water is shooting into the boat. It's flipping the canoe. And that's why you keep having problems. Tomorrow, because crazy enough, we were going to be on the river the next day. Tomorrow, when you make this run, every time you come to the rock, lean into the rock. The next day, we're on the river, my buddy and I. Of course, it was so against our instincts to lean into the rock that we'd yell it to each other. Lean in, lean in, lean in. We'd come to the rock, we'd lean in, and we would scoot right past through those rapids. It was like we were shooting through them with such precision. We were just following the course of the water. Here's what I can say to you that's been so transformative for me and the leaders that I work with. The things that you're not paying attention to are getting in your way. It's why you commit self-sabotaging behavior. It's why you can't form deep connections with people. It's why you can't move the team in a vulnerable way to either embrace the new initiative or to process why they don't agree with it. And so what we want to learn to do is how to lean in. And this is going to allow us to learn our story. So we're building here through a sequence, and we've got to start paying attention and learning our story and why we're here, where we're here, and what's happened. If you were to go into the boardroom today and sit down with everybody and say, listen, when we start getting into questions about certain initiatives and where we're at with them from a level of progress, I start to power up and try to control the conversation, or I start to fidget and hide because I don't want to go deep into that topic. If you were to say that to that room and say, I want to make an honest confession to you that you probably don't know, but here's what I do, and you call out your behavior with precision, for the most part, nobody in the room is going to be surprised by that. If I were to come home and say to my wife, you know, when the schedule gets packed and I've overcommitted myself, I start to get frustrated at little things and I get uptight and I know I'm a jerk to deal with. She's not going to say, oh my gosh, I don't know what you mean. the people in the boardroom aren't going to say, no, what are you talking about? They're already seeing it. It's time for you to see it. It's like you're out at dinner and there's a big piece of, you know, salad hanging from your tooth connected to a piece of cheese with a big piece of steak. This is obvious to others. And we don't want what's obvious to others to be missed by you. If you were to sit down with a biographer and he were to start helping you make sense of your story, or she were to help you analyze the timeline of your life and what are the key events and why this happened here and why that happened there, they could get you into a state of awareness where you would start to connect some dots that you've probably never connected before. Well, we want to learn to do that now. We don't want to leave that up to chance. We want to figure that out. And so that's what I mean by learn your story. Now, as we learn our story and as we start to pay attention to what's happening, we're going to figure out that we really have like this war of voices within ourselves. And we're going to start to pay attention to that. And I know that sounds kind of weird, but just hang with me for a second. Everybody I've ever coached, or when I speak to people and talk through this, you can break it down, if you want to think about it, as kind of three competing tensions. One is the part of ourselves that we want to project to others. So we want to make people think something about us. And this is the proving or the hiding. And we're going to hide because we don't want them to think bad about us, or we're going to prove, we're going to try to control their perception of us. So it's who we want to project ourselves to be, right? And then there's this part of us, it's almost like we're following this internal narration. We are driven with this story that we feel like we've got to live up to. And whether or not we've ever become aware of that, this narrator is oftentimes speaking in a voice of shame. Now, we talked about shame in the last podcast. We want to learn the difference between shame and guilt. And shame is when you feel bad about who you are. Shame is when you feel like you don't belong. Shame is when you feel like you'll never have a place where you're accepted and can feel at home. So we've got this part we'd like to project. Why is that there? Because this internal narration is driving us from shame. And then there's who we actually are, the way that we internally experience ourselves. And so we want to get awareness on how shame drives that thing that we want to project to others. We want to get awareness of the shame. We want to pay attention to it. We want to learn why it's there, where it came from, how it's there, so it will stop blocking up our leadership. Now, how are we going to do that? How are we going to learn our story? How are we going to declutter, you know, what we'd like to project, where shame is driving us from who we actually are? Here it is. It's going to sound crazy, and I kind of can't believe that I teach people this and say this, because for some people, they'll dismiss it so fast. It's learning to pay attention to your emotional state. For so long, so many of us have been taught in some parts of our lives that we're dominated by our emotions. You feel like doing something, you need to do it. You got to pay attention to your gut. You got to follow your leadership intuition. On the other extreme, we've also been taught feelings are terrible liars. They will mess your leadership up. You lead and you tell your feelings where to follow. And when you do that to yourself, you do that to others. And what you're doing when you lead like that is you are not getting deep buy-in from the people you're leading, because they're humans and you're human and we all have feelings. We've got to acknowledge that. You're also not creating momentum or energy. Look, vulnerability gives energy. Pretending drains energy. So you want to learn where you're at and what you're feeling and how to be vulnerable in planned, appropriate ways, right? You're not just breaking down. This isn't about neediness, but this is about knowing your emotional state, how to pay attention to it, because the more that you know your emotional state and pay attention to it, you're leading from an authentic place, and also the more that you're going to be able to pay attention to others and lead in a healthy and empowered way. So here, let me say it again. I'm not going to be dominated by my emotions, nor am I going to deny them. I'm going to be aware and learning, because they're critical clues for me. And so I've learned to pay attention to this, just to look people in the eyes and see them for who they are and where they are. And the more I do that with myself and the more that I do that with others, I'm able to be intelligent, emotionally intelligent, for them and for myself. I mean, all leadership is a journey. I'm on a journey. You're on a journey. You're taking your organization on a journey. How do you know how to get them there if you don't know where you are right now? So you got to have the destination, but you got to know where you are. And part of knowing where you are is an emotional assessment of things. You can force that new initiative down everybody's throats, but you're not going to get what would be a healthy culture, deep buy-in, accountability to the results. Instead, you just get tight lip service. I remember in the first meeting one time where I had taken over a team that had had a dysfunctional leader, and it wasn't the first meeting, but the first meeting where somebody actually called something stupid. It was an incredible moment because the team culture had been such that you couldn't say honestly what you thought or felt, or there was fear of recompense or punishment powering up on the team leader's part. Now, here's the thing. If they're not saying it in the meeting, they're saying it when they go home. I'd rather them say it in the meeting so we could figure out what's really going on than them have to have some kind of space in their life where they vent and process what's bothering them about what's happening at work. Let's deal with it in here. So I've been pleading with the team. Let's be honest. Let's get honest about where things are. And so we had an initiative passed down to us. I'm the team leader. I need to build respect for the team leader above me, right? My boss. But I also need to create an environment that's healthy. My boss above me led with fear. I'm trying to lead differently. And so in this team meeting, somebody finally calls an initiative that was passed down stupid. What do I do? How do I build respect for the leadership above me? And how do I, you know, praise and celebrate this moment of vulnerability and authenticity? So the first thing that I did, I just started clapping. I mean, I'm making a big deal of this. I want this guy to know, this is awesome, you did this. And we celebrate it. And we celebrate it, but we also have to frame things like, hey, we can talk about everything honest in this room. But when we leave this room, we're unified. So you were honest, it's stupid. Maybe we can make a change. Maybe we've still got to go with this program as is. I'm trying to use a complex example here to show you that the level and depth at which this works. Now, if I'm an insecure leader, when he calls it stupid, the emotion within myself, right, I'm going to either try to shut that down or run from it. Again, proving or hiding. Instead, I'm going to pay attention to what's happening on the inside of me. I'm going to be aware and learning. I don't want you to just to think about your leadership at work. It's your leadership in all of your life. I mean, I can remember at home one time, and this is an embarrassing story to tell, but it's just real life. And I was in a weak, vulnerable moment, and I punched a door in front of my kids. It wasn't because of something in between me and my kids. It was actually an argument between me and my wife, and I had a stupid, weak, insecure moment. And I acted out in such a way to try to prove something about myself and handle it in this immature way. I felt so horrible. Anytime you feel shame, you oftentimes will want to, you know, remove yourself completely from a situation. And so sometimes people get promoted at work and they don't actually live up to that promotion because they feel a sense of shame. I don't belong in this new spot. Needless to say, I felt shame as a dad and as a husband and, you know, went outside, left the inside of the house and crying and feel just completely defeated. And I'm talking to my kids about this hours later and processing it with them. And I said, look, it's not bad to feel strong emotion. It's unwise to always act on it. Sometimes you feel a strong emotion and you need to act on it. Sometimes you don't need to act on it. Daddy acted on this emotion in an intense way and it was immature. And it was okay for me to feel what I was feeling. I just needed to act out in the way that I did. And so I want you to start thinking about where you're at. It's almost like you have an emotional temperature that you're taking of your own life and of your own day and what's happening throughout the day. I don't want to be dominated by what I'm doing, and I don't want to deny what I'm doing. When I work with clients one-on-one, one of the things that I'll have them do is start to capture some moments where they may feel threatened, or they may feel afraid, or they feel really excited, and to start deconstructing those and pulling those apart so we can start making sense. Now, one of the things that you can start making sense of is all of these reactions, all of the emotions that we feel, all the times we feel falsely threatened in our identity, gear one, go back to the first podcast, are there because of some part of our story that's unfolding. Something's happening, something that was taught us in a false way. This goes back to fears, part two. The active and passive cuts, right? Hurts, shaping these responses. So we want to become aware and start paying attention to them now, and then we can start working on where they might have come from. So one of the things that I want you to start thinking about is when you look back over the trajectory of your life, what would it be like for you to list out maybe like a top five hurts, things that represent some epoch or peak moments, shiftings, experiences that you just know, this really shaped me. It's oftentimes these big moments that reinforce tons of small interactions that are happening. And they cause us oftentimes, because children are great recorders but terrible interpreters, to believe a lie about who we are. And so I think I may have used this example in another episode with you. If not, just a quick breakdown. But if my daughter's coming to me and saying, "Daddy, can you fill up my sippy cup?" And I say to her, "I can't wait till you're old enough to fill up your own sippy cup," right? And I'm annoyed at her and frustrated. And she just has this little thing triggers in her brain. Hey, my needs are a problem. And then she's at work 20 years later, and she can't ask for what she needs because she doesn't want to trouble anybody with them. Our lives are shaped by all of these forces and experiences. And for most of us, we've never pulled back the curtain on that and paid attention to it. And the food is dangling from our teeth, and we've never learned our story. So you can't really figure out who you are until you assess what you've been through. And this isn't about paying attention to our past in a way that we obsess over it or that we feel like we're defined by it. Look, your history is not your identity, okay? And your identity is bigger than even the thoughts that you have about yourself right now or the emotions that you feel. Who you are is solid and secure. But for us to get to that, we need to look at the shaping experiences that have happened up to this point. And so as you start to look at these themes, connect them back to the fears that we talked about in episode 2 and start to look at how do these fears relate to these points of cutting, these points where your soul just got hurt. Because it's different for all of us, but it's happening. And what happens as we start to process this and unpack this, light bulbs start to go off. And it takes some time. But the more we pay attention and lean into our emotions now, connecting it to our past, assessing what we've been through, and learning our own story, looking at some things that shaped us, we start to be able to be more present and be aware, not dominated by our emotions, not denying them, but aware and learning. Now, for some of you, you may have trouble getting to a place that you feel. For a lot of us, we do live very numbed out. We've conditioned ourselves through whether it's our lifestyles, our eating habits, different practices that we've adopted or habits or other things that we could call addictions. We've developed patterns of shutting down what we feel. If you have trouble feeling, if you feel numb, stop whatever the addiction is, right? It could be workaholism. It could be something that our culture would praise, 1,000 different things. Stop whatever it is you run to for a sense of comfort when you feel afraid. And most people aren't even aware that they're running to it. So that's why we got to get aware. But as we get aware and we stop running to it, here's what happens. That pain comes to the surface. And I'm telling you, this isn't like crazy stuff that doesn't relate to your leadership. I think it was Harvard Business Review just put out an article a couple weeks ago basically saying executives no longer have the privilege of ignoring what it means to lead with mindfulness. Emotional intelligence is another word that's been used. Another way that I would say it is to be aware and learning. So this isn't something that you can choose to not do or do, and it's optional. Your relationships are going to be blocked up. Your sense of focus and clarity and mission is going to be off kilter. Your ability to connect deeply and engage the team and engage your own self in a wholehearted way, it's just not going to happen. And so I'm really trying to plead with you to stop whatever that thing is, let the pain come to the surface and start paying attention to it and start processing it. Figure out who you can talk to around you about what's happening. And it's got to be somewhere that you can not just have to posture and try to influence your language, not just talk about it factually, but get to that really third level of language that's primal, where it's visceral and you feel it. And maybe you got to write it out. And that's something I ask people to do in the coaching program. What's it look like for you to take one of those hurts and write a letter out? I mean, go old school. Pen and paper, if that helps, to make it really visceral. Write it out. Don't give it, of course, to that person. But get it on paper. Start to feel it. Own it. Know it. Be with it. Because what's happened up to this point is the pain, the hurts, the lies, they've all shaped this response in your leadership. And you want to learn your story. I had a really intense encounter with this about a year ago. Now, before I get into that, a little bit of the backstory here. In the sixth grade, I choked on a piece of KFC chicken. We were on a family vacation, and my dad had to jerk me up, do the Heimlich on me. And I remember, in a very intense way, this chicken shooting out of my mouth. It was gross, to say the least. Moving forward, it was about college where occasionally, I don't know, maybe 9 months a year, every so often, I would have this sensation where I would get food stuck and I would feel like, you know, oh my gosh, I can't breathe. This is happening again like it did when I was in the sixth grade at KFC. I'm going to die. And you literally feel like you stop breathing, and I'm a fan of breathing and getting air. And so you'd start to just freak out and get scared. And, you know, just learn through that I would try to like get water and force it down and do whatever I could. Well, I was on the first date with what would be my future in-laws, and we were at a restaurant, and I'm eating, and it happens. I get the food stuck. I mean, just right there in the middle of the restaurant. It's one of these bad experiences where you just feel completely consumed with panic. And instinctively, I remember jumping up and seeing a woman's face a couple of booths over, you know, just shock on her face. And my father, not yet my father-in-law, but soon to be father-in-law, jumps up and turns me around and tries to do the Heimlich on me, but it's not working. And there's a trash can right there. And this is a super gross moment. I apologize to do this to you, but it's essential to make the point. I take my fist and I ram it into my mouth and take my fingers and I gag myself right there in the middle of the restaurant. I still remember that woman's face going from shock to disgust. But what happened was by doing that, I was able to dislodge that. And now, oh, I can breathe. And of course, went to the bathroom and cleaned up, came back, sat down. And like any normal human being, I finished my meal, right? I still remember that my wife and future mother-in-law did not finish their meals. So moving forward, I've had that happen a number of times. I just learned, hey, I jump up, I run to the bathroom. If it happens at home, I shut the door, turn on the fan, don't want to traumatize the kids, do a quick gagging of myself, jump up and down, get it dislodged, it goes down, I'm good. And so this happens, you know, once every year or so. Well, I'd finished a major school project. It'd been 5 years of working on finishing a dissertation in the classes, and it was the first Sunday night where I didn't have something to work on. And a real sense of freedom. And so I told my wife I was going to go and get a steak at Kroger. We had already had dinner. I go to Kroger, I get this steak, and I bring it home. And you got to do it right. You got the iron skillet, heat it up, 500 degrees, sear it on both sides. I'm telling you, man, this was an incredible steak. I get it cooked up, and I get a bite. Tastes delicious. Take the second bite, and it lodges in deep and hard in a way that I was completely panicked. My wife knows when I step up and go to the bathroom like that in a rushed way because something is stuck, just to keep everything calm, it'll be okay. This was different. I looked at her eyes and made contact with them, and she knew this one was way bad. She takes off out the back door towards across the street to a retired EMT and starting to call 911. I run to the bathroom, and I start jumping up and down, just violently trying to get this out of my throat and landing on my heels trying to get it dislodged. I finally get some air coming through, and I come out. My kids are just crying. They're scared. It's so traumatic. I get a hold of my wife. I yell. I say, come back, come back. It's got some air. I go out on the porch. I keep doing what I got to do to get it all the way down. It takes a while. I come in, and you know when you get that look from your wife? And she's like, you are going to the doctor. And so I go to the doctor. And I'm with the nurses, and they're doing the little studies, and they watch everything, and the inside. It's really gross. But here's, as they do a case history with me and walk through all this, they say, if you were really getting it stuck in your airway, you wouldn't be able to dislodge it, and then it goes down. because it would be going into your lung. We think every time since the sixth grade that you felt like it was stuck, it was a trigger to this traumatic incident. And they said that your brain can actually trick yourself to the fact that you can't breathe. And what you would do is you would pass out, but you would wake up because you would start breathing. My mind was blown. Every time that I thought that I was choking, I actually wasn't. Since that happened, a number of times when food has gotten stuck, I'm able to tell myself, you're still breathing. It's going to be okay. It's going to go down. And because I stay relaxed, it does go down. I was having, even my brain, this reaction based on a completely false understanding. And here's the thing that I want to make so clear to you. There are reactions that you're having, and they're based on completely false understandings about who you are. You want to learn who you are? You learn your story. You want to learn your story? You start looking at what's happening in you emotionally, and you start looking back at your past, and you connect dots. And as you get to more and more the truth of who you are, this is going to unleash the desires within you so that you really figure out what you want to do in the world, who you want to be as a person. Lots more we could say on that. Lean in, okay? In some way, lean in and pay attention to what's happening. Peace.
This has been The Sight Shift, lead podcast with Chris McAllister. Thank you for listening.